This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. We live and work in buildings. How well do they work? The buildings and green spaces that surround us, do they please us? What cultural, economic, and political forces shape our environment, the built environment? The architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune, Blair Kamen, is our guest this afternoon. He joins us to provoke our thoughts, answer our questions, and listen to our thoughts on the built environment. Blair Kamen has been writing essays on architecture for the Tribune for a decade. He's the recipient of many awards for his work, including the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism, the George Polk Award for Criticism, and the American Institute of Architects Institute Honor for Collaborative Achievement. And he is an 8-time recipient of the Peter Lisagor Award for Exemplary Journalism. Kamen is the author of Why Architecture Matters, Lessons from Chicago. The book is a collection of his columns for The Trib. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Blair Kamen, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. It's good to be with you.
Do many major daily papers have an architecture critic?
Not enough. There are about a dozen that have a full-time architecture critic, and others have part-time architecture critics who also write about art. But in far too many newspapers, including USA Today, the Houston Chronicle, and others in major cities, architecture is really only covered as real estate, not as something that affects the everyday life of thousands of people.
Yeah. Well, real estate is part of the story.
It sure is, but it's not the whole part of the story. This is about much more than dollars and cents.
Yeah. I would, after looking over your columns, I would wish for newspapers everywhere, whether or not they can have an architecture critic per se on staff, is if they would from time to time look around their communities, including the one that we live in here in Champaign-Urbana, and do some work in this area, do some series from time to time.
I think that's a great idea, and in a city like Champaign-Urbana, with an academic faculty that is focusing on architecture and also urban planning issues and also engineering, you can really have guest writers who give their opinions on various proposals, and the whole point is to get a dialogue going. I mean, architecture really is what's often called the inescapable art. In other words, you can ignore a painting, you can ignore a sculpture, but architecture is just there. You can't get away from it. And if it's bad, you've got to live with it. And yet, architects often talk about architecture in this kind of strange sub-dialect that, I call archibabble. You have no idea what they're talking about when they're talking about, post-structuralist, deconstructivist, post-modernist, all these strange words that they, fly around. The whole idea of what I do is to try to really democratize this inescapable art, to make it accessible to lay people, and to give them standards by which they can kind of judge the built environment and make informed decisions. So if they want a park to be a certain way or a building to be a certain way, they can make their views known to the powers that be, whether it's City Hall or developers.
Give us an idea, if you would, about how you approach a building in terms of whether you are going to like it or not like it.
You mean, I just flip a coin like that?
No, I know you don't do that.
But
how do you size up a space, and how do you say, this is good, and this is, that was a mistake?
Right. Well, I think that, the most important thing, obviously, is to see the building many times and to see it in the flesh. In other words, there are some critics who will make judgments just based on pictures, if you can believe that, just like two-dimensional pictures. And architecture is really three-dimensional. So, you have to go in the building. You have to walk through the building. You have to walk past the building. You have to talk to the people who use the building to see whether, form follows function. You have to judge the building in the context of the city, so you're not just judging it as an isolated object, but rather you see how it relates to its surroundings. You have to judge its structure and whether its structure really has anything to do with its form, or whether it's just kind of whether the outside of the building is just sort of slathered on and really is essentially like window dressing and really has nothing to do with the actual construction. So there are really many ways you judge a building, and what I try to do is not have a single sort of polemical way, you know, like you have to have a modern building, you have to have a traditional building. I try to judge buildings on their own terms, but also according to a kind of flexible set of standards, you know, that can apply to buildings of different styles.
Yeah. And buildings, it seemed to me, have to be comfortable living with one another.
I think they do. I mean, I also think that they can often challenge one another. When I say that buildings have to be judged by how they respond to their neighbors, I'm not saying that like one building has to imitate another. There's a wonderful example of this kind of conversation between different buildings going on right where I work in Chicago at the Michigan Avenue Bridge, where you have the neo-Gothic Tribune Tower, the neo-Spanish Revival Wrigley Building right across the street, and then two other 1920s towers across the Michigan Avenue Bridge to the south. All these buildings are different stylistically, but the architects clearly kind of set up a kind of conversation of different styles that makes for an extraordinary urban space and really an incredible ensemble of four different building styles, but somehow they all work together. So I think that in our cities, which are really formed by business decisions, that kind of collision of different styles and forms is often what makes our cities lively. And certainly I think one of the ironic things now about the collapse of the World Trade Center is that, I mean, you know, these were buildings that were reviled. I was among the people who reviled them. They were too big, they were ugly, they were bland, they had nothing to do other than their height with, you know, the lower Manhattan skyline. And yet, in a sense now, I think we all miss them because they were kind of this collision of modernist forms with the earlier 1920s towers in New York. And they did give something to New York, especially in terms of, they were almost, as someone I just talked to, an editor in New York, said they were like giant sundials. They kind of gave people a way to orient themselves as they went through their day in Manhattan, and they also kind of helped mark time as a sundial would.
Mm. Last night on television, I heard a man say that a child told him it looked like New York City was missing its two front teeth.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a, I don't know quite if it's two front teeth, but certainly part of its face changed. And I really am intimately familiar with what that child said because I grew up in New Jersey and went to the beach all the time as a kid. And we would look out from the tip of this peninsula called Sandy Hook at the lower Manhattan skyline. And, you know, you just saw these things rising up as solid and as impregnable, seemingly, as the pyramids of ancient Egypt. And to the whole notion that those things are gone is mind-boggling.
Yeah. You wrote the introduction to this book, Why Architecture Matters, prior to the attacks on New York City and the Pentagon. But terrorism was in your thoughts when you wrote that piece. You mentioned the bombing, the earlier bombing of the Trade Center,
right,
and the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts today?
Well, I think that those attacks really prefigured what happened on September 11th, and they really, for anyone who was paying attention, demonstrated pretty clearly that Americans who thought they were once immune from terrorist violence were sadly misinformed. I think that what really has happened now is that we see, you know, with 2020 hindsight, that how these attacks in the 1990s prefigured what happened on September 11th. I don't think anyone realized, though, that, you know, what was going to happen on that day, and certainly even as it was happening, people were shocked. I mean, I'll never forget, I was sitting at my terminal interviewing a structural engineer before, you know, both of the towers had been hit, and the structural engineer was telling me how he thought that the towers would probably stand up because they're They had lots of closely spaced structural columns on their perimeters, and that was redundant enough, as engineers say, to let the buildings take the hit of the airplanes and still survive. And I'll never forget, I mean, I was interviewing this guy and typing up a story, and one of my editors came over and said, you know, the towers had collapsed, and it was just, I still can't believe it, you know, that it happened. So it's, I think really what we've seen here is that, you know, these buildings were emblems of permanence. You know, they look like they would just be there forever. And to see these things, this, you know, this material substance just dematerialize in the space of, what, a, you know, 10 seconds, just utterly shaking, because I think buildings like this really are truly landmarks. They mark the land. I mean, that's the whole meaning of the word landmark. And they give us a kind of sense, I think, a psychic sense inside ourselves that there are certain fixed points in a very disorderly world. And when those fixed points just disappear in the space of seconds, the world seems a little bit less orderly than it did before September 11th.
Yeah. Before September 11th, when you wrote this introduction, though, you also wrote the explosions, those earlier explosions at the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City and at the World Trade Center back in 1993. You wrote the explosions did violence to more than their intended targets. They spawned a fortress mentality that trampled upon the nation's tradition of accessibility and openness.
Right.
And now today, here we are, and security is even a greater concern, and it is an important issue. And my question is, can we build in security without walling ourselves off?
I think we really can, and I'm really glad you asked that question, because here in Chicago, we're really seeing some classic overreaction to the danger posed by terrorism. For example, there are concrete barriers that have been set up in front of Sears Tower, the John Hancock Center, and the Amoco Building, or the now called the Aon Center, the three giants of the Chicago skyline. Clearly, those things are necessary. I don't mean to suggest that they're not necessary in most cases. I hasten to add. I mean, if I were working in Sears Tower right now, I would want, you know, protection against a terrorist truck bomb like the one that hit the Oklahoma City Building. But I think we've also seen some overreaction. I mean, just for example, at the Aon Center, the former Amoco Building, there are, you know, jersey barriers up in front of the building. They're ugly. And really, one has to wonder if they're necessary, because there's already like a huge moat in front of the building. So for a truck bomb would essentially have to, you know, fly over the moat and go into the building. I sort of wonder if those barriers are there really more to give people inside the building a sense that, you know, they're being protected, and to sort of protect the property managers from lawsuits or anything like that. We've even seen in Chicago here, there's a wonderful building called the Rookery, which was built in the 1880s and is really a classic, has a wonderful atrium inside of it called the Light Court. This was a favorite spot for architectural tours. And, you know, the Rookery is maybe, I don't know, 8 stories, 9 stories. And that light court, which was originally designed by noted architects and later redone by Frank Lloyd Wright, is now closed to the public. Now, I mean, who's going to go after the Rookery? I don't think that's very high on, you know, terrorist list. It's hardly a symbolic building, and yet that's a classic example of how, you know, buildings have been kind of walled off. So I really think here that there is a way to balance security and openness, but in many cases there's been, you know, kind of overreaction to what happened on September 11th.
Yeah. What can you tell us about how the Europeans have dealt with this in architecture there on that continent?
You know, I don't have a good answer, I'm sorry to say. I do, you know, having been in European airports, obviously, you know, you see soldiers and a much more heavy military presence. I think in many cases the answers are right here. I mean, for example, in Chicago, the Federal Plaza, which has the Kluczynski and Dirksen buildings in it, as well as the post office, really was a model before September 11th of how to balance security and openness. There was a farmer's market there every Tuesday. There were activities that drew people to this plaza. There were all sorts of things that really made it a government center that was part of its community in a lively public space. And ironically, on September 11th was a Tuesday. And so a farmer's market had been set up. And, you know, after the attacks, they closed it. They barricaded this plaza. And now it's really more chilling because of those Jersey barriers than, you know, I mean, I'm more scared in that plaza because it's barren, it's empty. It's kind of like a ghost town, whereas at Daley Plaza, the other great plaza in downtown Chicago, just a few blocks north, they've really tried very hard to keep a sense of normalcy. They have concrete granite benches around the plaza that protect it, but they also have activities there. And like Halloween, during Halloween they had a Halloween festival there. Now they have, you know, Christmas tree, menorah, and other things. And one of the things I think is that the presence of people really makes other people feel safe and in turn attracts even more people. So I think these are good examples of the fact that, like, doing normal things while taking security into account really is the best way for us to go on with our lives rather than sort of overreacting to the threat of terrorism and just shutting down the very democratic way of life that we're really fighting to protect.
Mm-hmm. A few minutes ago, you talked about your office neighborhood there, which is, you're so lucky to work there. It's a lovely area. And those four buildings hold down that intersection so magnificently.
Right.
Now, just a little bit a ways away from where you are, Donald Trump wants to build a skyscraper there on the riverfront.
Right.
And the plan is to locate it where the Sun Times building is now.
Right.
What are your thoughts about the proposal? Have you seen drawings, pictures of, you know, what the architects are thinking about?
If your listeners haven't read the story, the Donald has proposed building a 78-story, 1,073-foot skyscraper where the 7-story Chicago Sun-Times building sits right now. You know what? You asked a very good question. What do I think about this proposal? And I have a rule. I never scoop myself. My review of this proposal is in the paper tomorrow in the Tempo section. And all I can say is the proposal needs a lot of work. And that's about all that's about the biggest hint I can drop. But I think that gives you a sense of where I'm going on this plan.
Okay. I was curious, you know, I guess I was caught unawares of apparently there are plans for the Sun-Times to move to another space.
Yeah, that's quite possible. They really haven't made it clear yet what they're going to do.
Okay.
I think that I hope they stay, I mean, because, you know, that way they can be our competitors right across the street. But I think that what's really driving this deal is really, you know, money rather than them, the Sun-Times, keeping their historic spot in, where they've been for a long time. So we'll see. But the review is in tomorrow, and I think that you'll see with a little more clarity both what I think of this proposal and also, interestingly enough, how September 11th affected the plan. I think that's a very interesting part of this. Because remember, Trump initially was proposing the world's tallest building at this site, and now he's proposing only the fourth tallest skyscraper in Chicago. The building shrunk, at least in height, and somewhat in square footage. So I think it's pretty clear that September 11th affected this proposal. I think it's also clear that the Donald has a ways to go before he does something that's exactly right for the site.
Yeah. Well, I would think that September 11th played a role in scaling back also the economy.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think what we're really seeing, and it's fascinating, is there is a great fear of you know, many tenants who are in these very tall buildings, like the Sears Tower, really are kind of freaked out about, you know, being up there, and they feel like they're targets, and some of them are thinking about going to other spaces. Is that real? Is that irrational? I don't know. I just think that if I lived in the John Hancock Center, which is the great X-Brace Tower that has, you know, the world's tallest condominiums in it, I would find it very hard to go to sleep at night. Because, I mean, at least the people in Sears Tower know that they, when the day's over, they get to go home, you know, to their little one- or two-story houses or three-story houses, whatever they live. But when you go to sleep at night and you're lying there in bed thinking about goodness knows what could happen, you know, on the 90th floor, I think that would be rather challenging. But ultimately, though, I think those fears may be irrational, and this is really... You know, people have said, should we build skyscrapers? Should we make skyscrapers more secure? Yes, we can do things to do that, but ultimately, really, this is an airport security problem. I mean, those lapses in that system are what created the problem on September 11th, more so than poor structural design.
Blair Kamen is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune. A collection of his columns now available in Why Architecture Matters, a book from the University of Chicago Press. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, thinking about the Chicago riverfront, it has certainly undergone a lot of change since I was a kid, and it seems to me for the better.
The riverfront or the lakefront?
The riverfront.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Sometimes
people confuse the two. Yeah, I think that the riverfront really is looking up, and in the distant past, probably long before you were born, Celeste, the riverfront really was an industrial alleyway. Buildings turn their backs to the river, like, say, the Lyric Opera House does. But now I think the river really is being seen as a seam that can join what's on each side of its banks rather than a barrier that separates them. And we're seeing a river walk that's being developed and is a wonderful place to kind of, you know, drink in a little bit of water and beautiful urban vista. And I think the river's really being seen now as a recreational resource rather than just an industrial throughway. And what's most important about the river, in a sense, is this. The lakefront, people really think of Chicago as a lakefront city, but of course it really was the river that helped make the city a great industrial center. And the whole point now, really for the next century, is to take the great green space of the lakefront and to extend it inward through the core of the city, through the river, to make the neighborhoods along the river great neighborhoods, just like we see the Gold Coast now with all of its high-rises. I'm not suggesting that we need, you know, a wall of high-rises along the Chicago River, but that river can be an incredible resource for spurring new development in neighborhoods that sit alongside of it.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to thank Mr. Kamen for his articles. I appreciate reading them in the Tribune. I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier in the program, if I could, in terms of the World Trade Center. I was also with not an engineer, but an architecture student here at the University of Illinois when the towers fell, and he was speculating that part of what caused that, it was something I've not seen written up in your columns or others, and that is the weights at the top of the tower that keep them from moving around in the wind, and that perhaps it was that weight that when this really caused them to pancake, as we saw.
Well, you know, that hasn't come up so far. I did a big interview with Gene Corley, who is a structural engineer in Skokie, who's actually heading the inquiry, the federal inquiry into the collapse of the Trade Center towers. And they really are focusing on where the collapse started. And that could have, it seems, occurred in one of three places. One would be the perimeter columns, the very closely spaced perimeter columns of the building. Another would be the columns of the building's core, That was the core that surrounded, like, you know, stairwells and elevators. And then thirdly would be the lightweight floor trusses that really supported the floors. And I thought it was fascinating that Mr. Corley was able to explain to me that, in contrast to the Oklahoma City bombing, where, you know, that building, the Murrah Building, fell in a matter of 3 seconds, the World Trade Center towers were stood up for 56 minutes and an hour and 40 minutes, respectively. And so there was an incredible real-time record of these buildings as they collapsed and right before they collapsed. One of the things the investigators are looking at, for example, is, as you may know, one World Trade Center had a communications tower on top of it. If the communications tower started falling before the rest of the building, that may be a sign that the core columns of the building fell first, because that tower was, that communications antenna was supported by the columns at the core of the building. So it's using all kinds of structural sleuthing like that that they're going to hopefully determine what happened and give us a clearer idea. But so far, I haven't heard yet that they're considering what you mentioned, those weights up at the top of the building.
I did read that article and appreciated it very much, and do like your writing. Let me ask one last question. I'll hang up. In terms of what you were saying earlier about not judging a building just by its drawings, mm-hmm. Would you like to say a few more words about your strong opposition to the plans to renovate Soldier Field, since you've only seen drawings?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, when you're judging a building beforehand, you can only go on the drawings, but you also have to go on your experience of the site. And what you're referring to in this case is the fact that the Tribune, including both the editorial page and I, have been crusading against the plan to insert a massive bathtub-like seating bowl inside the historic columns of Soldier Field. This would be an utterly incongruous design, something that really wouldn't be historic preservation, but rather a kind of mock example of historic preservation, because the colonnades would be saved, but their form would be utterly transformed by this enormous seating bowl on top of them. So all we have to go on are the drawings. So I think in that case, you know, when you're analyzing something beforehand, it's utterly justified. What I was talking about in terms of reviewing a building was, you know, after it's done, you can't just look at the pictures of the drawings. You have to go see the thing, itself.
Let's talk with another listener, this one on line 2 in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi, I wanted to ask you to talk about a couple of things, and I'll hang up and listen off the air. And that is, can you update us on the Millennium Park?
Sure.
And the other thing is this whole thing about Meigs Field. I don't get up there that often, but I really enjoy the whole downtown campus area, museum campus, et cetera. And it'd be brilliant to have that extend even further south. And it just seems that the mayor's got the right idea on this point, that really should be a common use area.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a general way of talking about just common use.
Right. Well, I couldn't agree more. And let me do Meigs first, and then we'll do Millennium Park. As many of your listeners know, Celeste, I think that there's this narrow little island or peninsula called Northerly Island, which has an airport on it, general aviation aircraft. And this is largely used by small business planes, but also, more importantly, state employees who go back and forth between Springfield and Chicago. It's really a kind of political sacred cow because it's an enormous convenience for them, and that's why I think in large part the Governor Ryan is fighting to keep this thing and has cut a deal with Mayor Daley as part of the O'Hare expansion plan to keep Meigs open. I couldn't agree more with the listener that Meigs should go, because it sits right next to the museum campus, which is this 60-acre culture park, which has the Field Museum, the Shedd Aquarium, and the Adler Planetarium in it. Having something there that is strictly for the use of state employees and people who use private airplanes is just, nothing could be more in opposition to the fundamental principle that the lakefront is and should be open to everybody, regardless of race or income. So I really wish they would get rid of MIGs, but the mayor has cut this deal, and it's going to be hard, I think, to undo it. Now, with regard to Millennium Park, that's this project that has skyrocketed in cost. It's in the northwest corner of Grand Park, and it's building a park over working railroad tracks. Lots of additions have been made to the park, like a bandshell by Frank Gehry, and other things. The problem is that these additions have forced bulkier structure to support them from below. And so this park, which originally had a price tag of $150 million, is now well over $300 million. And it's really a textbook example of bad planning, because the city planned it as they went along, and the structure had to change innumerable times, and the costs are reflecting that. It's really a classic instance of bad planning.
Let's continue to talk about the lakefront. One of the very interesting series that you did that's in Why Architecture Matters has to do with the lakefront and disparities in green space from north to south.
Right.
I was wondering if you could tell us what the situation is today, and how quickly is the city moving to provide more green space and more amenities south.
Well, this series is a major part of the book, and the series is called Reinventing the Lakefront. It ran in 1998, and it really points out that there still is an incredible disparity between the North Lakefront and Lincoln Park and the South Lakefront, Burnham Park and in particular, which is just south of the McCormick Place Convention Center, in terms of the number of acres, the number of restaurants, the number of bathrooms, public art, you name it. And this disparity really has its roots, I think it's fair to say, in race and class. In other words, the North Lakefront is the lakefront if you're white and affluent, and the South Lakefront is the lakefront if you're poor and black. And it's really been ignored over the years, and even wasn't really being planned very well, despite the fact that a couple of major public works projects were going to be carried out in the near future. So anyway, as a result of the series, the city did do some planning, and they are starting to correct this disparity with more acres and better facilities on the South Lakefront. And I think it's really, a credit to them that they're making these first steps. Whether they get enough money to continue it, given the recession and the dip in the federal budget, we'll have to see. But I really hope they do. It's nothing really, I think, is more important for Chicago's future in many ways than narrowing that gap and creating a balance between the North and the South Lakefronts.
In a similar vein, how's the city doing in terms of progressing in a public housing program?
Well, I think the city is again taking some key first steps toward tearing down the high-rise buildings that really proved to be warehouses for the very poor, filing cabinets, really, and trying to create mixed-income developments that don't have the kind of pathological concentration of poverty that you got at places like Cabrini Green and Robert Taylor Homes. Architecture is a key part of this, because architecture can really help change the perception of an area if you have, nice housing that middle-income or lower-middle-income people would want to live in. Then there's a chance, at least, the door is open to creating a more mixed-income community. The flip side, of course, is whether or not these mixed-income communities will include the very poor people that they're intended to help. And we're seeing at Cabrini Green now a real test of that. There's some new replacement housing going up and high-rises coming down, and this development is right next to downtown Chicago, prime real estate. And the real question, I think, and we don't know the answer yet, is whether there's going to be a place for the very poor at Cabrini Green in the future. I'm skeptical that there will, but I think we have to hope that, the city will, and the city and the Chicago Housing Authority will make good efforts to encourage a real mixed-income community there. But it's just too early to tell.
You'd think that would be a prime area for mixed, if it was going to work anywhere.
Absolutely. I think, if you just think about it, what's happened is that you've gotten people who had to move off the site. So reconstruction could occur, you know, they move, they get settled somewhere else, and then they may not want to come back. It's just human nature, I think, once you settle down, to not want to pull up stakes and move again. So it's a very challenging thing, and you know, keeping track of all these people as they spread hither and yon is difficult. And so I think, you know, this is a classic instance of where architecture alone can't solve these problems. I mean, I think there was a real myth that, you know, people built, I mean, we built high-rise housing, and then it was these big, bad buildings that, you know, they created the projects and made them bad places to live. And I think nothing really could be further from the truth. If we concentrate the poor in low-rise housing, we're likely to see projects that are every bit as messed up as, you know, the high-rise ghettos of Cabrini-Green. So it's much more complicated. Architecture really has to work in concert with, you know, job programs, social programs, and other things to really, you know, change the course of people's lives. I mean, just building better buildings isn't going to give you better lives necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something that has been a lot of fun in Chicago in the last few years was, first of all, the cows.
Uh-huh, sure.
And then this summer, the furniture.
Right, the chairs.
The chairs, excuse me. Well,
yeah.
It seemed that there was more than chairs going
right,
on.
Right, the sofas, right, and then the TV sets and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the cows were great. I mean, there were a lot of art people who, you know, said they were way too commercial and they were art light, L-I-T-E. I thought they were wonderful because they really gave people a chance to kind of come into the city and see these kind of strange, exotic, you know, colorful things. And, you know, you have to really step back and look at this in the broadest sense. I mean, here's Chicago, the city of very tough, very serious buildings, you know, all right-angled and black-tie elegant like the Mies van der Rohe buildings. And, you know, here were these kind of curvy, crazy cows with all these different colors. And, I mean, it was as though, you know, we were sort of in like a yuppie version of Calcutta, you know, with all these sacred creatures going around. And they were wonderful just to watch and to be surprised by and to laugh at. But I think what was most important about them was that they gave people from entirely different walks of life an excuse just to talk to each other, to stop, to pause, to chat, and maybe kind of break down some of the social barriers that normally exist in everyday life. I mean, this is one of the great things about cities. You know, why do we have cities? Well, we have them so we can be close to each other, so we can, you know, work efficiently together. But I think one of the great things about cities is that they allow us to celebrate each other and to, you know, rub up against each other and to express our differences rather than suppressing them. And I think that that's what the cows really accomplished. They gave they reminded us that cities, which had been proclaimed dead as recently as the 1970s, really came roaring back to life in the 1990s. And I think we really saw an appreciation of what cities can do, which is to, at their best, you know, bring people from very different circumstances together and to let them live in a kind of civilized way.
Well, what did you think about the chairs?
I thought they were okay in terms of the way they emphasized the importance of what we call street furniture. In other words, you know, it's always nice to have a bench to sit on or a place to kind of hang out if you're tired from shopping and all that. But they were a lot less exciting visually than the cows. I mean, the cows were, like, really cool because they had a kind of animal force to them. I mean, they were, you know, they were like animals walking through the streets. They seemed like real live beings and therefore dynamic. I mean, remember, it was a parade, so you got a sense that, you know, all these creatures were kind of, you know, roaming through the streets like they're, you know, the bulls running in Spain or something. Whereas the chairs just sort of, you know, you sat in them and the chairs just kind of sat there. They were kind of inanimate. They were not particularly dynamic, except for the ones that were kind of stacked up on top of each other. But those weren't really chairs. Those were just, you know, sculptures that were, I mean, they turned the chairs into sculptures. So I don't think they were quite as successful. And I think it was a good try, but I don't think that they were as great as the cows. The cows really were wonderful and very, very hard to top.
Well, for what it's worth, I like them both, and I had the pleasure of being with a 9-year-old boy. Who thought that was just great, some of those furniture settings where especially like, oh, I remember my friend's son, Nick, he just went crazy over some of the things that were more creative. Like there was one on Michigan Avenue that was like a soda fountain.
Right.
And it was so much fun to see him investigate it. It was like, is this real, and spin on the stool and that kind of thing.
I think those were fun. I mean, the ones you're talking about, they were interactive and playful, and those were some of the better ones, but I think just as a whole, the cows really had it over the chairs.
So is another round of this kind of public playful art in the works?
God, I don't know. I think all these cities have imitated it. I mean, I know New York had, their own cows on parade. I sort of thought that it would have been smarter if they had a bunch of rats on parade. that sort of would have been more in this, that's sort of the municipal creature that I most associate with New York. And I say that jokingly because I grew up in that area. But, I don't know. I think a lot of cities did them. There were horses in Kentucky. There were all kinds of things everywhere. And, a lot of people make fun of the tourist trend that has transformed cities, and I'm one of them. A lot of cities have just created kind of theme park versions of themselves, and that's really one of the themes of the book. You see, we had this thing in Chicago called Capone Chicago. It was this kind of tourist trap for people who could experience what it was like during the during the Prohibition era when Capone was, a violent gangster killing people. But as my colleague Mary Schmeek, nicely put it, this place tried to turn, this cold-blooded killer into your sweet chipmunk-cheeked Uncle Al. It was just this, total Disneyfication of history. So as bad as all that stuff is, I do think that there are positive aspects to the tourist trend that has, fed the growth of cities, and the cows were one of them.
Yeah, well, those things bring people into the city, I suppose, but, I got to be honest with you, it's one of the last places I'd want to visit. Planet Hollywood and all those Michael Jordans and stuff like that.
I think there's really a Faustian bargain that cities make because they gain all sorts of sales tax dollars and they get people in, but they kind of lose a lot of their soul. As someone said, I think a lot of these places are essentially like a halfway house for suburbanites who are trying to, reintroduce themselves to the city. That's my colleague Bob Campbell from the Boston Globe made that crack about Faneuil Hall in Boston, that it was sort of like a halfway house for suburbanites. So,
Well, I think, too, that cities, I think that there can be something for everyone. Hopefully, there is.
Yeah, I think though, that you do want to get everybody under the tent. The problem is you also want quality and you don't want the city to really become a theme park version of itself. And certainly, initially I think people thought that the theme park joints like Planet Hollywood and Capone's would just sort of stay to themselves just west of Michigan Avenue, but instead they spread to Michigan Avenue. One of my favorite targets in the book is the Disney store on Michigan Avenue, and this is a grotesque imitation of Louis Sullivan's organic ornament. It has 170 mouse-ear decorations on the facade of the building. I think it wins the award for over-branding in architecture. So I think that's sort of the danger of this kind of trend because once you start theme parking the city, we have no idea where it will ever end.
Yeah. We're out of time, I'm sorry to say. I hope we'll do this again sometime.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
Okay, take care, and we'll look for your column tomorrow on the Donald.
Yeah, it's in the Tempo section, and okay. We'll see if it maybe improves the plans a little bit. I hope it does.
Thanks so much. Blair Kamen has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, a collection of his columns, now in Why Architecture Matters, Lessons from Chicago. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press. Blair Kamen is the architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune.